Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today I'm joined by actor, comedian, filmmaker, triple threat, Joe Avella. He is one half of the sketch comedy duo Teenager of the Year with Tim Racine, and his work has appeared on IFC, Spike TV, WTTW's Image Union, and has also been screened at various festivals, including South by Southwest. He recently completed his first feature. It's a hilarious picture called Master of Inventions, which can be viewed in its entirety at joeavella.com. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me, Matt.
Well, I want to start with this Teenager of the Year because
sure.
This is how long have you been involved in this comedy duo?
That me and Tim did that or have been doing that for about 4 years now, I believe.
4 years.
It was just him and I. We met out here in Chicago doing other stuff, and comedically we clicked. So we started focusing full-time on that as far as like live performance stuff. And yeah, it was really great. We got a chance to do a lot of comedy festivals like San Francisco Sketch Fest, and been to Seattle and L.A. and a bunch of other ones. So yeah, we did that for several years. He currently has relocated to Brooklyn, New York. So now it's kind of on the back burner. I am going out there in July to do some shows with him, but yeah, for a good 4 or 5 years, that was like our main focus.
The thing I like about the show, because you have some expanded, you know, there's many online videos you can get of this as
definitely.
Well, and it seems like one of the approaches that you have is you try to engage the audience as well within
Absolutely.
The sketches. It's
Absolutely.
Like self-conscious sketches
Absolutely.
That you're kind of creating, and it's the banter between both of you in between the sketches that get the biggest laughs.
That was a conscious choice. We had found that our distaste for a lot of the comedy that was going on in Chicago sketch-wise was very polished and neat and trying to replicate theater, and people were putting out very well-produced videos, you know, and we just thought that it took away the excitement. It made the comedy very sterile and uninteresting.
Mm-hmm.
So one point that we made is that we were always going to constantly try to make everyone aware of the fact that we are all in a room together. You're looking at two guys on a stage on a Friday night for some reason. you're constantly talking to the audience and like using the responses as feedback to keep going on, because we wanted to be anti this movement that was happening and still happens in Chicago sketch comedy, where they, you know, lights down, lights up, they pretend it's like a theater piece, they have props and sets. We just wanted to do the exact opposite of what everyone else was doing, and that kind of style was born out of that concept.
That's cool. Well, because I'm wondering if you do take those, because sometimes you ask, like, does this even work? Like, there's certain times where you really are kind of, like, gauging the audience perceptions.
Yeah.
And is some of that genuine, or is that part of the act?
It was all genuine, because, you know, that wasn't day one. We kind of evolved quickly into that. But there's something so liberating about when you're performing. Everyone gets nervous about performing in front of people for obvious reasons. They don't look stupid. They don't want to come off as, you know, idiotic or bad or whatever they're doing. But there's just something so liberating, refreshing to just engage the audience and talk to them. And yeah, if you do something and it goes bad, to turn and comment on it or go, what do you guys think? How's this going? And
mm-hmm.
depending on what they're thinking, you kind of go back and forth, and it becomes almost like a conversation almost,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense, you know? And it made me personally, I'm sure Tim would feel the same way, it made us instantly so comfortable on stage that we tried to recreate the feeling like if we were just hanging out somewhere and joking around and riffing, like try to make that kind of like feeling of just from the hip, anything's going to go, anything goes, what are we going to say next, kind of comfortability that, you know, people enjoy in conversation, like try and put that on a stage.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what your thoughts are regarding Conan O'Brien, but I was a little reminded of him.
That is so funny you should mention that. we developed this style that was 100% kind of influenced by what Conan used to do. I think he still does it, but back in the day when he was really getting his footing, he'd always do this thing where he's like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, and now this character, and it'd always be like a ridiculous character's name, that would get a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
The character would come out in his visual representation, that would get a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Then it would kind of die, and then the audience would laugh at the fact that it didn't have an ending, and then we'd come back to Conan, he would comment on how poorly it went.
Yes.
So we had that same mentality for our sketch comedy, and still do. We're like, this next sketch is called whatever ridiculous thing. And then we do that ridiculous thing. And then we talk about how ridiculous that ridiculous thing was,
mm-hmm.
and then go on to the next thing. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And he still does that. He does that, like, you know, the glory days of his late night show when it's really
Conan
its best.
Conan still does it, yeah.
I mean, that's why the masturbating bear is so famous, you know, because it's just
exactly.
the name gets a laugh, the visual gag gets a laugh, and then his reaction to all this gets a laugh.
And like doing it over and over again, so there's like comedy in the repetition, like trying to make something so incredibly, useless and pointless, like the focus of a sketch. You know, we had this one sketch. It's actually one of our videos where we're like, okay, we got to get rid of this dead body, and like, okay, throw everybody one, both like pretend we're holding a dead body, like we're doing like 1, 2, 3, and we just count up to 64. That's the whole sketch, and just people in the audience would be like scratching their faces, like, oh god, when are they gonna stop? But we just like this, like we just took the seemingly the most small, minuscule, pointless thing of a normal situation, not normal, but like a normal comedic situation. Mm-hmm. And like that's the thing we're going to focus on. And the comedy is the fact that we're focusing on the thing that no one else had.
Yes. You know what I mean? And there's a similar sketch where you're listening to the radio and so much of it, because you're playing like the same, it's the same repetitive theme again and again. And all the humor comes from the behavioral
kind
of nuances, you know, the driving, the adjusting, the volume. And
everything
like
I want to say that that is not like, this isn't like an original concept. I mean, we see stuff like this in Mr. Show and Kids in the Hall.
Sure.
I just always responded more to that style of comedy that more took almost like sketch comedy tropes that already existed, like the stuff we'd seen a million times, and like try and pick the thing or the twist that no one had ever done before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I like going to like the places that we've all been to, like, you know, the first dates and the long lines of the DMV, or, you know, the settings that everyone's used to in sketch comedy, and just finding that one thing that no one ever really like picked out and made it humorous. And that to me is like more exciting than trying to come to something completely original and, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm always excited when people are kind of deconstructing the formula of what an audience is expecting. And that's what I think Conan does. I think like his scripted gags are not nearly as funny as the ad-libs he comes up with. And if something goes completely wrong, he'll still get a laugh, because it's all about the audience is sharing in the experience of the performer, which I think is what I see happening in some of those videos with you guys.
We would always say that the material that we go prepared, which is very little, is secondary to whatever happens in the moment. One of our favorite things in the world, and this is why if you were to see us now or the past couple of years, we're constantly like, what do you think, audience? To kind of like be kind of a little confrontation with the audiences. There's nothing better when someone starts to heckle or interrupt or some sort of thing where most people be like be scared if someone started talking or said something during their set or their show. We welcome it, because the second someone in the audience would do something, we just had this unspoken rule, me and Tim, just like, okay, we're done with whatever we were just talking about. We're going to give this person all the attention for the rest of the show and just abuse and just turn the whole show about this person and how annoying they are and just drive it into the ground and get to so many laughs. And the audience would respond to it because they can't stand this person who's talking. So, of course, they're like, yes, let them have it. And the person who wanted the attention is getting the attention that they wanted.
Exactly.
So they're happy.
Because that's what they're looking
for. And we're just like, we're just riffing like crazy.
There's also this thing that I think is also part of Teenager of the Year, these jock jams. I'm sorry, it seems like you released your first album of these jock jams.
Yeah, I just pitched the idea, one of the million other ideas that me and Tim are constantly pitching to each other. It becomes the idea, let's do a jock jams album, because we both were talking about doing something music related, and of course we wanted to do something that's like exact opposite of any other music that a comedy group would put out, you know? So We had felt, but discussing several options, that we kept coming back to jock jams because like the music is already inherently funny and nobody takes it seriously. So let's try, the joke would be to try and recreate the best as we can jock jam style songs that we remember from like, you know, the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah.
So yeah, we ended up putting out I think it was 8 or 9 track album.
Yeah.
It's available on my website for free. Or, Megashare got taken down, so I put it up on you. Just, on joeavella.com in the audio video area, you can find a link. It's on SoundCloud as well. Just Google search.
I think I saw it on SoundCloud.
Yeah,
and it's funny because there's a song that actually instructs you, like you have to listen to this either in like a dance hall or the bedroom.
Right, because we when listening to all the music, a lot of jock jams early on were all either about working out or having sex or dancing.
Mm-hmm.
But it would speak in a way that you didn't know which one it was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of just thought like, okay, this song's only for the bedroom or dance floor.
Yeah.
And if you listen to me, the lyrics are purposely, not comedically, like, but just incredibly vague about moving and sweating and getting into it and going harder and harder. Where it's like, wait, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I guess like it could apply to either setting.
Exactly. Well, and has film always been something that you've aspired to? Because you've done shorts all throughout this. So,
it was actually,
so has that always been something?
Well, I don't want to say it was the thing that I aspired to, but it was the first thing I started to do like creatively on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, way before any of this, I got a degree in graphic design. Because in high school, the only thing that I was any good at was like art stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to being just another graphic designer in his mid-20s that, you know, isn't really getting anywhere and that passionate about it. You know, I just started, a buddy suggested we make a movie and a video. And we did a short and it was fun. And I just like, it was like the thing that, you know, instantly from the day the guy was like, we should try this, I just became obsessed with it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I went and got books about it. I read about how, like, I just, it instantly became the thing I was the most excited about. So I guess the writing was on the wall. Like, I want to do this more than anything else. And eventually I gravitated into comedy, which got me in the Chicago comedy scene. And then, yeah, just making shorts over and over again. And then, you know, YouTube became popular and a mm-hmm. standard for sharing videos and film festivals. And, yeah, I just didn't look back at, like, I don't think, I wasn't like a kid sitting like, one day I'm going to make movies. It's just one of those things that when I tried it, I couldn't stop.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? Absolutely. Now, this Master of Inventions,
sure.
This film with Jeff Murdoch.
And yeah.
How long have you known Murdoch? Because he's kind of a prominent figure.
I think I've known him for about 5 years now. We're on an improv team together. We've been friends and performers for about 5 years now.
Now, were you both kind of instrumental in creating this character? Because the whole thing is about this inventor who
yeah.
he reminds me of a bit of the OxyClean guy, where it's like it's like a guy who's famous for people hating him. Like, you know,
yeah.
he's famous because people can't stand
for
him.
For products that sound stupid and you've never actually seen them, you just know about them through the commercials, you know?
Exactly.
Because a lot of that actual infomercial stuff, it's like I don't. Everyone knows who the who's that really annoying guy? The rag that cleans up the really Vince here from. What's that towel called? I can't believe him.
Yeah, oh, geez.
It's so popular, I just instantly
exactly.
forgot what it was called.
Exactly.
I'm looking at the guy. He's also famous for, I don't want to say the other thing he's famous for, but anyway, so everyone knows exactly who the guy is, but I don't know anyone who has the product that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you see, like, the Billy Mays guy who had, who had all the cleaning stuff. It's like, I you know the guy, you instantly recognize him, but I couldn't guess two things that he's made, let mm-hmm. alone know anyone that has it. My point being that when I started making this movie, it had been after making shorts for 5 years for no money.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I wanted to make a feature film, as anyone does. And, of course, I didn't for a long time because why can't I? Because you need lots of money to make a film, right?
Mm-hmm.
So after a short stint after a visit to South by Southwest, I had a short there. I had the luxury of spending most of the time with people in Interactive and got totally hyped up on the idea of making a movie for no money because everyone I'd met there who was in the Interactive portion – you know, had like a blog or a website or something or a podcast or mm-hmm. a business that they started from nothing. Like no money, didn't go to school for it. Just it was a passion that eventually became their job.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought was, why can't I do that for movies? So when I came back to Chicago, I thought, forget this trying to get discovered with shorts and raise money that way. I'm going to make a movie the way I make shorts, which is for no money. I borrowed equipment with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started writing, it was just like, I got to write something that I can shoot for free. And this idea of, like, this hapless inventor who has all this garbage that everybody hates kept coming up because, like, the comedy is in kind of, like, the commercials I can make for it. And also I can use a lot of different locations and all my comedic friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the reason that Jeff kind of came to the picture is that just writing it, I would force myself to imagine people I knew kind of embodying the parts that I was currently thinking about. And
mm-hmm.
just for whatever reason, he kept coming up whenever I'd writing this hapless character that, you know, can't catch a break and everyone kind of rags on. And then, you know, I asked him and he said yes. So as far as using him, I mean, I don't say it could have been anyone because once I picked him, it shaped with his style of humor. But I don't know. He just kept coming up and I thought, oh, I'll just use him. And it went from there, you know?
Yeah, well, he's such a – I mean, I thought there was a real inherent sweetness to the film because, I mean, he does get battered around. There's a lot of humor at his expense. But I never felt like the audience was at the same time identifying with him. I was wondering
that
if that was an important component.
Yes, that was absolutely important. I had made a point to try and watch as many, like, very low budget or independent comedies and saw a lot of ones that, you know, on Netflix that no one had ever heard of. And I noticed that, like – people, when they first start doing comedy, and people who haven't been doing comedy a lot, they think that the humor is just jokes, 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 and specifically jokes where, like, people are the victim,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that actually doesn't work. And I name any comedy where the lead character is a total idiot who keeps failing and nobody likes, they're still – the good ones, you're rooting for them because you love them. I'm thinking, like, The Big Lebowski and Dumb and Dumber and Kingpin.
I thought of The Office a little bit,
Yeah, and The Office, like – and the reason it is because as dumb as this person may be, as flawed as they may be, as – annoying, and even if their motives you don't agree with them, you have to care about them, and you'll care about them if you look for the, I guess, humanity in their actions.
Sure.
And at the core of Jeff's character and the story is a guy that is trying so hard to do stuff that, like, connects with people and makes their life easier, and he loves to invent and do stuff, and just the business and his own, I guess, greed or meekness or his own shortcomings have caused his problems. He's trying to overcome them, but he's just painfully shy and lets people kind of walk all over him because he wants to be liked. And I'm not saying we're like that specifically, but I think that's something that people can identify in themselves in some way, and therefore you care for him. Because if not, it's just a guy who's getting made fun of for an hour, and nobody wants to watch that.
That's right. Then it just becomes just like one joke.
I mean,
just one note.
I think if anyone, you know, can think of like a comedy that they dislike, that's probably at the core of it is like awful people that you don't want to see succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You don't care what happens to them.
Yeah, because it just feels mean-spirited.
Exactly. And that's I didn't want it to feel mean-spirited at all.
Yeah. And there's some hilarious, so some of the ideas of these inventions. I think my favorite was the singing GPS, where it's...
thank you. My friend and fellow filmmaker Ben Bowman made the commercial that's in the middle there.
And
enlisted some friends to do it. And I believe it was his brother who wrote that song.
Oh, okay.
Man, it is such a catchy tune, too. And it just perfectly... Like, it's almost accurate to how I imagined the song would be. And for those of you who know what we're talking about, one of his inventions is a singing GPS.
It's a singing GPS.
And it turns your GPS directions into a song that you listen to while you're driving there. And, of course, it's the most irritating, like, endless song because, you know, it's like a 30-minute
song. Merge to the left.
And then, like, you know, every time the directions change, like, the tone of it changes, sort of. So there's no, like, real chorus to it. It's just like a nonstop, almost like roaming minstrel sort of, like, song. And so that's kind of the idea. Like, I guess a lot of the inventions, although they're crap, I wanted to pick things or, you know, made a huge list, and I picked the ones I'm like, you know, I could see someone actually making this. I could see at some point this idea for an invention was like the heart was in the right place,
mm-hmm.
but then it just clearly doesn't work for obvious reasons, you know, like as opposed to something that's just so ridiculous that anyone watching would be like, well, of course no one would invent that. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that seems what links a lot of these products that people kind of make fun of is like, who would need this?
Exactly. But
who would need this? Yeah, and so in your face about the pointlessness of it.
And, you know, and someone's buying them because money's being made.
Someone's
but again, the same thing could be argued about all the appliances you see in late night television because they're the same way. You go, yeah, I understand that thing, you know, boils eggs super fast, but like, who's making that many eggs? Or, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
See things, you're just like, yeah, I get it, but so what? You know, like, I don't want that on my counter, you know?
No, I think you've done some aspiring filmmakers a service here because not only did you make this film, you also had a very comprehensive production diary on the website where you really kind of share some of the, you know, struggles that you went through, a lot of this. And it just reminded me of like a lot of other stories I've heard of other filmmakers I've talked to. And you have some very interesting like tips as well for low-budget filmmakers. And one I wanted to mention was this idea of the director should also edit. And
absolutely.
I'm wondering why is that a key to the success of
it is
your
a key
work?
For success because if you're going to make your own, first of all, absolutely, you should absolutely make your own movie on your own for free right now. If you have any thought like maybe you can do it, maybe you can't, you definitely can and you should. And one of the reasons we're talking now is why the director should also edit is because the Hollywood system, the way things were done for a long time was the director never got a chance to edit it, so a director would have to like shoot everything from every angle and get every coverage in every single detail, and then because they hand it off to a person who wasn't there, and all they get is lists of shots and what to use when, and they cut it together. So everything has to be dialed in, which is a way you do that if you work for a studio and you're shooting a film. But when you're doing it digital, you know, the camera that I shot this movie on is a lower definition than the one that's on the iPhone. So any camera is fine. Mm-hmm. But if you're the one that's editing it, your shoots can go so much smoother and have so much more life and excitement because every shoot that you're going to do, no question, there's going to be problems. There's going to be issues you need to resolve. You're not going to be able to shoot it the way that you want to. And you're going to make decisions right there on the spot to change and go, you know what? I wanted to shoot it here. I got to do it this way instead. I'm just changing it. And since you're the one that's editing it, you can make that decision on the spot. You don't have to worry about running it past another person or shooting it all these different ways and then trying to explain to someone later what you did.
Mm-hmm.
If you're editing it, and editing equipment is software, you know, most computers come with it. You can kind of BitTorrent it if you want to get, you know, a little illegal about it. I did. But the point is that so when you start making your own film, you can make decisions in the moment. You can craft because you're going to be crafting it the way that you want to. So you don't have to worry about having to like slow down. Does that make sense? You know?
Absolutely.
And I also, I mean, not only to edit it, but I also did like the sound and. And it's just like, also, if you come up with an idea in the moment, like it's a comedy for my movie's a comedy, and you know, I'm shooting this thing. Every scene's with like four or five other fellow comedians. If somebody comes up with something that's funnier, let's do that instead. I'm the boss. I decide if we do it or not. If I don't, no, I say no. And there's several times where people go, I want to say a line this way or that way. Why don't we cut it back this way? And I go, yeah, that is funnier. Let's do that. And I'm the editor, so I get to make those choices, not to worry about
some other person. And your project's improv-based, and I suppose that principle is even more relevant and vital for something that is, you're shooting hours and hours of footage. How can we whittle this down into a narrative? Yeah. And I think you also say you like to balance, you like to edit during production.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how you balance that, because when you're working within a tight production schedule.
Well, actually, the production schedule, when you do it for no money, is an interesting balance of tight and loose.
Mm-hmm.
It's tight because you have very small windows of when you can shoot and where you can shoot and very limited resources. So when you do shoot, it's like, yo, man, we're here for an hour and a half. We got to go. I don't care. Make it happen. Go. But then I would also have sometimes months where I couldn't shoot anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of waiting till everything's completely shot is ridiculous, because to try and remember what I was thinking 3 years ago, 4 years ago when I first started, when I'm like looking at the footage for the first time, that wouldn't work.
Sure.
Also, when you're shooting scenes, for instance, there's some things where I'd be shooting and realize that I can't do it anymore. It's like further down, another scene further away that I haven't even shot yet. I can make a change, make a change that we shoot for the thing we're shooting. I keep saying shoot. Make a change for one thing and make a mental note that, okay, when we shoot the next scene that this is connected to, I can change that. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So, and when you're editing it, and not just there, but like there have been plenty of times where once I start cutting a scene together that I shot a couple days before, I'm like, oh, this doesn't work. That joke didn't work. I'm going to cut that. So now I know in the future not to shoot or change it to something else if I want to shoot the other scene. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I guess you can kind of do the same thing if you were making a movie just that and shooting it over a couple weeks. But this thing, I have time to edit it and look at it and think about it. And that way it's like when I start shooting again, I've already made new decisions because I've looked at the footage. I know if it worked or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it's a very funny movie. People should definitely check it out on your
website.
Thank you very much. And I'm wondering, what do you think is next for you? And you know, taking from this experience, this first film, are you already planning on another one?
Absolutely. I don't know what it's going to be. I understand that this film was, I guess, the culmination of 5 years of making short films, learning how to make films, use camera equipment, who to work with, and how exactly it goes. And then with all the things I learned and all the resources that I had acquired over those years, I made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to say it's like back to square one. Now it's like a new plateau of now I'm going to go back and make a lot more shorts. Who knows, maybe a web series, and now just go back in because I know so much more about filmmaking and how I want to do it. I have access to better equipment. I have access to more people who are more excited. I have more of a name for myself. So now it's just going to be another process. I like the idea of having a process of like, okay, now to make a bunch of small things, try new things, work with new people. And then while doing that, going to try and see what's working and what's not again. And then hopefully by this time next year, I'll be on my way to writing the next feature.
Very cool. And you've cited Lloyd Kaufman's book.
Absolutely.
As a make your own damn movie is
the
name of it. And so how has that helped you?
That movie, that book. Oh, thank God I found that book. It is that and Robert Rodriguez's Rebel Without a Film Crew are the only two books I'd recommend for anyone who's interested in making a film. They say pretty much the same thing. You want to make one, you'll figure it out. Get what you can now, make it for free, write around resources you have fun with it, say what you want to say, do what you want to do. Once it's done, get as many people as you can to see it. And once you're done, start over again and just keep building and building and building. Don't wait. Don't try and get lots of money. Don't move anywhere. You have all the resources you need right now. Just do it and keep going and keep going until you start making better stuff and have fun with it, you know? And yeah, it's Lloyd Kaufman, who is the founder and president of Troma Films. I'll admit, I don't even like a lot of those movies that guy puts out, but the fact that he makes them and it's his job and he's found people who do care is very inspiring. So,
yeah, so it's great advice for any aspiring
filmmaker. Yeah, the book is excellent. Check it out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Joe, for being
on
the program.
Thank you very much, man.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, real quick, you can see my movie for free at masterofinventions.com.
Yes.
It's also on my website, but masterofinventions.com. It's right there. It's on Vimeo. Please feel free to give me an email or tweet me or whatever. My email is joeavella@gmail.com. I would love to talk to anyone about what we talked about here today. If you disagree with me, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Anything, I'd like to love keeping the dialogue open about indie film. And thank you very much, Matt, for having me.
Absolutely. And that's the man's info. And check it out. It's a great film. And for all my recent reviews and interviews, visit HollywoodChicago.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.